Great. I think we will get started now then. Bardan, good morning. Welcome to everybody who's joined us for today's conversation. My name's Auriel Miller and I'm the director of the IWA, Wales's leading independent think tank. For those of you who don't know us, we have a long track record of shaping debates and influencing change in Wales through our policy and research and advocacy, our online and print publications. And if you haven't seen a copy of the Welsh Agenda, our latest magazine, do please get hold of one via our website. We provide platforms for robust comment and debate, and today's conversation is one such example, and our agenda setting events. We're sorry we can't meet up in person, obviously, at the moment, but better for everybody that we don't. We're a membership organisation with members right across the country and much further afield. We're funded by our members, the events that we run ourselves, and independent trusts and foundations. This is our 12th Rethinking Wales panel discussion, and we'd like to thank the Carnegie UK Trust for supporting us in this chunk of the series. It's our last one before Christmas. A little bit of housekeeping first. As this is a webinar on Zoom, participants are muted by the host, and we're going to use the Q&A section for questions. If you'd like to say hello, please do so through the chat. And if you'd like to direct your question to a particular panelist as well, please do that through the chat function and through the Q&A function too. Please remember that all chats and questions are recorded, and we'll be putting this on our YouTube channel and on our website afterwards. They are these sessions have been viewed, I think, over 1,000 times since September, so they're getting a really good reach. We're going to be keeping the event strictly to an hour to avoid Zoom overload, but we'll keep the chat room open for a little while longer after the end of the session if you want to carry on the conversation. So, croeso and welcome everybody. We started this series of Rethinking Wales discussions back in April, early April, because we wanted to shine a light on what matters most to people at this particular point in time. Our reality continues to change, and because we're still not able to meet up in person. Today we're asking, has Wales actually performed better than other nations so far in our COVID response? Polling suggests that people in Wales still think the Welsh Government has done a better job than the UK Government in keeping us safe during the pandemic. And statistics show that after the first wave, excess deaths in England were 46% higher than last year, and in Wales only 26% higher. But should we have set a far higher bar for our response than just being better than England? 26% higher is still 26% too many. Have we done as well as could be expected under the circumstances? We're going to hear from our panelists in a moment, but we also want to hear from you in the chat room today and on Twitter using the hashtag Rethinking Wales. I'm delighted to introduce today's panelists. We have Patience Bentu, welcome Patience, who is the Community Engagement Officer for Race Council Cymru. Ivion Evans, Chief Executive of Ceredigion County Council, welcome Ivion. Dr. Richard Stanton, who's a reader in virology at Cardiff University, welcome Richard. And Dr. Aelia Hughes, GP and freshair.wales campaigner and vocal Twitter fan. I'm going to come to Patience first, please. Well, our key question to start off with is really, has Wales performed well in our COVID response? Can you give us a couple of minutes, please, Patience?
To sum it up in one sentence, I would say definitely Wales has done well. Wales has kept up the pace, leading in the decisions that have kept us safe in Wales. If you remember, going back to the start of the pandemic, Wales was one of the first to lock down before even England went into lockdown, the central government went into lockdown. And coming up to the second wave, Wales again led in the firebreaker lockdown before other governments did, and I think this is highly commendable.
And I know we're going to come to the conversation a bit later on, Patience, in terms of the impact of COVID on Black, Asian, minority ethnic people in particular, because of the disproportionate impact that it's had on them too. Ivion, could I come to you please next in terms of how you think Wales has performed? You're on mute, Ivion.
Yeah, sorry, schoolboy error. generally, I think Wales has done quite well. I think the challenge that we're facing at this precise moment in time is that There's fatigue out there. That people have had enough of the circumstances and the rules and the regulations that they adhere to. And it's probably the most dangerous time of all for Wales. We have done better than the majority of other parts of the UK. And that brings an element of complacency in as well. So whilst we could say we've done well to this point, I think this is the absolutely the tipping point where we could get it horribly wrong. Mm. And the challenge is today. And I hope that government sits up and thinks long and hard about it and makes the right decisions moving forward.
Thank you, Eavan. And with numbers rising, Richard, you know, key concerns that Eavan's bringing our attention to, numbers are rising. We know that capacity of the NHS is really stretched already, and there's and we're only at the beginning of winter.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that there are definite positives from the way that Wales has handled this outbreak. I think their messaging has been strong. I think their ability in the messaging to sort of bring people along and create a kind of feeling of we're all in it together, let's all do our bit, has been very good. I think they've been more willing than perhaps England to bring in stronger measures earlier, which we know are really important from a public health perspective. But I think we also need to bear in mind that if we do international comparisons, the UK as a whole and Wales as part of that is a part of a group of countries that it really wouldn't want to be in, along with America, with Spain, with France, with Italy. These countries have seen very, very high numbers of cases and very high levels of deaths. You know, there are countries in the world that have completely eliminated this virus from their population. And so I think it's absolutely appropriate that we look at those countries and we ask the question, what have they done differently to us? And could we learn a little bit from what they've done?
Yeah, that's great. And I think we're going to come and dig into that quite a lot more in a bit. Eilir, your perspective, please, in terms of how Wales has done well so far.
Morning. Yes, I think it's fair to say that if you compare Wales with the rest of the UK, particularly with England, I think, of course, we have done better, and the figures speak for themselves in terms of the excess deaths. But I always come to that point, well, why are we comparing ourselves with England? Okay, we are in close proximity, and of course, we're under the same UK government. But should we not be looking wider and looking at what other countries have been doing? Be more worldly about it, as Richard pointed towards. You know, look at countries of a similar population, or roughly in the same sort of categories, like the smaller nations within the EU and also New Zealand, and even those countries with huge populations in the far east. They've managed the pandemic far better than we have. And when I say we, I mean Wales and, of course, UK in general. Yes, if you compare with what happened with the initial lockdown, with the first wave, I think the approach that was taken careful and planning before bringing in new changes, that was a smarter, more considerate way of going about it. But I think soon as things really opened up, I think we could have done a great deal better.
Okay, thank you. So some challenging conversations there. Richard, let's come back to you. I mean, it's really difficult, isn't it, to make comparisons between countries because there are so many different factors. Can you just sort of set out some of the things that other better performing countries have done and maybe talk a little bit about why we haven't copied them, and let's just investigate that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think ultimately there's really only two things that work in the absence of a vaccine or treatments. One is lockdown in some form or another, and the other is test, track and trace. And so the countries that have done really, really well in this outbreak have really majored on those two factors. They have locked down hard, they have locked down early, and they have made a really, really good job of finding the people who have the virus and then tracking the people they've come into contact with. And also really importantly, when it comes to test, track and trace, not just looking at who that person may have infected, but where that person was infected from. That enables you to sort of identify these super spreading events and get on top of those much more quickly. So I think those are the two key things that we've seen occurring in countries that have done very well.
So because one of the challenges often talked about for Wales, and I think, there are reasons why we compare ourselves with England, both politically and geographically, obviously. And it's because we have a long porous border, but there must be plenty of other countries that also have long porous borders with other countries who have also taken a grip and done things differently. And I know there's issues around, and we'll come to this, there's issues around why, for instance, the fire break was only 2 weeks. Well, at the time, the furlough scheme hadn't been confirmed to be continuing beyond the end of October, so it wasn't possible to know that people could be supported continuously on furlough as is now the case till the end of March. But other countries with long porous borders that have done better than us.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Germany in Europe is often held up as the poster child of what to do well in this outbreak. It's got lots of borders with lots of countries, but it devolved its test, track and trace to its local authorities. It gave them power to do that job really, really well. It's not perfect. You know, they had a first wave. They're having a second wave now. But they've also had a very strong lockdown. It's almost impossible to do effective test, track and trace if your case numbers are high. So the two things kind of go together very well. You have to do your lockdowns, keep your cases low, and that enables your effective test, track and trace to come in. And Germany have done that very well. And we're seeing now that their sort of current lockdown status is lasting for longer than ours. It's a little bit harder than ours. And I think that's the right thing to do and why they've been successful.
And I think some of the issues around the federal nature of governance in Germany with strong local state governance and also a very clearly scientifically led and empathetic leader as well. We'll come back to that in a bit. Egan, can I come to you and can we dig into a little bit more about Ceredigion and how you did things differently in Ceredigion right from the very beginning in comparison to other local authorities? Can you just talk us through your thinking right at the start and the decisions that you made, please?
Yeah, certainly. Right at the very beginning, going back to January almost, we were monitoring the spread of the virus across Europe and realised that this was going to land on our doorstep very, very shortly. So we put together a strategy that had four component parts to it. We had a preparedness phase, implementation phase, adjustment phase, and the recovery phase is yet to come. Hopefully that'll come with the vaccine. But the preparedness phase was basically getting the authority ready to cope with the volume of the COVID virus. That meant that we had to look at the variables that were within our control. For example, we heavily reliant on the tourism industry. So we spoke with our partners in the tourism industry and said, look, we need to close you down as quickly as we possibly can, because you almost double our population when you're in the height of the tourism season. We've got two universities in authority, so we had to speak with them about virtual learning arrangements. We try and keep our numbers down to our base population level. So that all took place in mid-February, beginning of March.
And can I just ask, how did those conversations go down with those partners? Were they understanding or say that you're overreacting? What was the response?
The response was we reduced our population numbers by 35,000 in 1 week. So I think that speaks volumes for how everybody took it very seriously from the outset and said, yeah, we need to make sure we protect our local community. And everybody took ownership and responsibility for it. So and that was a key moment, I think, in helping us at the outset of the first wave. The other thing that we did, we looked at, you know, the projected data that came from Public Health Wales, and you boiled it down to our authority. It suggested by the summer we could anticipate 600 deaths. Well, that wasn't palatable to any of us. So articulating that through a communication to the general public, not hiding away from it, telling them what the scale of the problem was, so we could all share that responsibility collectively. You know, all citizens across Ceredigion had the same understanding of what the challenge ahead was going to be.
And how did
and then the willingness to work with us?
How did you set that kind of crisis comms, crisis communications process in train? Because it's got to be clear, it's got to be regular, repetitive, coordinated in all sorts of different ways. And we're going to come to that with you, Patience, in a minute, in terms of how that worked for the communities that you work with. But in Ceredigion, you've got a very rural community too, haven't you? And we know that people aren't getting their news necessarily from Wales-specific sources. So you've got a great challenge there, not just in Ceredigion, but right across Wales.
It's about having community
so
connectors.
Can you talk us through that?
We had a clear comm strategy set out. We used a range of multimedia opportunities. We also identified community connectors out there, so we could have go-to people who could share this consistent message with everybody. So that was that networks, those networks were set up from the outset, and the voluntary sector aided us enormously in all of this because they took responsibility as well and for sharing that communication with everybody. The other thing we did, I think, which was critical at the time, at the height of the problem in Italy, when we saw what was happening in care homes in Italy and Spain, we immediately decided to cocoon our care homes. So we had a very different approach. We overstaffed them so that there was no need to transfer staff between care homes. There was no risk of cross-contamination between care homes. We equipped them with digital technology so that we could have, that the families could contact the loved ones in the homes from a very early stage. So our care homes were cocooned probably about 2.5-3 weeks before the national lockdown came into place. And that was a learning point that we took from what was happening in Europe at the time. The last thing we did as well was we focused on virtual learning techniques for our children. We could see that what was coming down the track would mean that we wouldn't have face-to-face learning in schools. So the teams were focusing on, right, well, how do we use digital technology? We need to make sure that we got equipment shared out to as many children as possible so that there's equity and access to learning. And if we can't do that, what other arrangements can we put in place? So we undertook a raft of activities to support the lockdown period. I think the success of the lockdown period was measured then with when we came out of the lockdown period, the infection rate in Ceredigion, in total, we'd only had less than 15 confirmed cases throughout the lockdown period. So I think that all of those actions early on demonstrated that we did the right ones. Yeah.
So, patients, I'm going to come to you, please, in terms of that public health messaging, because there are clear challenges, weren't there, to make sure that the messaging coming from Welsh Government, and we'll pick up in a bit in terms of how much more other parts of Wales could have learned from Ceredigion. Richard, I'll come to you for that. But patients, could you talk to me a bit about the kind of early conversations that you had with Welsh Government about how that messaging needed to be different for the communities that you support, both in terms of not in terms of content, but in terms of how it was communicated?
Yeah, I think our job was a bit more complicated because of the diversity of the ethnic groups that we support. It's not easy because we've got people from different, you know, diverse backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds. And on top of that, we've got quite a number from within our ethnic minority communities whose first language is not English. Yeah. So from the early stages, we envisaged that we were going to have that problem of language translation. Now, another credit to the Welsh Government is that from the very early stages, we started getting invited. I mean, third sector organizations working with ethnic minority communities started getting invited to conversations and meetings with the Welsh Government and Public Health Wales officials. And we, of course, with the disproportionate effects of COVID on ethnic minority communities, we were feeding back to the Welsh Government the sort of feedback that we were getting of the effects of the pandemic on our communities. And one of the major things that we discussed with the Welsh Government and Public Health Wales officials was the issue of language translation. And yes, they do have that, you know, they did have it in their website, the Public Health Wales website, from the start. However, we realized that the languages were not sufficient. Mm-hmm. And there was a wider need within the communities because the information was not reaching these people because their languages were not represented on the Public Health Wales website. Now, I have to again give credit to Public Health Wales because they set up another group where they were working very closely with organizations and trying to sort out that problem. And they were very kind enough to share their website designs with us and saying, well, what languages do you think have not been represented? How can we translate the information that we want out to the communities in those languages? Where do you think, you know, should we position it here? Would it be easy for people to access on the website if they click down, you know, to the drop downs and everything? It was very detailed interactions that we had, which was very, very useful. However, again, there was the challenge of not many people being able to access Public Health Wales websites because of internet issues. Some people, particularly members of our asylum seeker and refugee groups, did not have access to technology. And so they were not able to access the information that they needed during this time. And so we went back again to the meeting tables and we said, well, outside of information that's going out through the website, more needs to be done. And one of the ways that we suggested was leafleting. Well, considering the pandemic and the sort of precautions that needed to be in place, we could not do door knocking, which has proven to be one of the most effective ways of communication that we have within our communities. We have volunteers within the communities who go door knocking and sharing information. However, we couldn't do that, obviously, because of COVID. And so we thought, well, leafleting was another very useful way of doing things, slipping leaflets through the doors, you know, of members of our communities. And that was quite a successful way of getting information out there. And I'll tell you the other challenge that we had as well with cascading information. And it was, we found that there was an imbalance, a regional imbalance in the way that the information was going out. And there were a lot of our smaller community groups in rural areas that were not receiving, that were receiving very little or no information at all. So there was more information in the urban cities and towns than, you know, within the rural areas. And we discovered that when we started conversations on the with the Welsh Government on the Race Equality Action Plan, and the Welsh Government asked us to carry out a survey with our communities to get feedback that they would in turn, you know, put into the development of the Race Equality Action Plan. And when we went back to the communities then, this was when we realized that there was a discrepancy in the way that communities were receiving information. Obviously, the rural communities were very thankful, you know, that they felt they had never been consulted before. And they're so grateful that we've come to them now, you know, to sort of listen to their voices and to feed this back to the Welsh Government. Whereas in the big cities and the big towns, we were hearing, oh, we've been having these conversations for so many years. When's action going to take place? We're tired of talking. So yeah. That imbalance as well. Yeah. But on the whole, I would say the Welsh Government and Public Health Wales have done quite a lot of work with us to be able to get as much information as possible in the safest ways possible and in as many languages as possible, far more than has ever been possible.
I remember early on checking patients on the Public Health Wales website what sort of languages the information was being available in, and I remember spotting that it wasn't in the sorts of things that I would have expected it to be in from my own experience working in international humanitarian emergencies for a long time elsewhere. And I was also thinking, you know, if I was either an asylum seeker or refugee in another country, or somebody who had moved to another country for work purposes, I wouldn't necessarily know the name of the official body whose website I had to check to find out this information. You know, so there's assumptions that people know what is the institution that is responsible for this. So I think, you know, coming back to that, some of the things you pulled out there is a need for checking the rapid feedback loops, the checking, has this landed in the place that it needs to land? Who is assessing the level of understanding among the communities that are going to be significantly impacted by the information that you're sharing? And are your actions and reactions being informed by their experiences too? Richard, I will come to you in a minute, but I'm going to go to Aileen next, because I think this point about how evidence changes, doesn't it, in terms of the, you know, there's an approach that you intend to follow and a set of principles that you intend to follow in your response as a government and a response as authorities in whichever bit of the system you sit in. But evidence changes as we learn more about the virus over time and its effect on different communities. So you're based in the Shetland Peninsula, I understand, and you know, in a rural area too, you're seeing things, you know, there are issues around centre and periphery that play out in all sorts of different ways across Wales, obviously, not just Cardiff and everywhere else. Can you talk to me about a little bit about your experience as a GP as well? And what you have been able to influence and what you'd like to be able to influence even now?
Sure. So if you think about our area, yes, it's a rural area for the majority of the time, but during the peak holiday season, school holidays, the population swells up to three times, yeah, because it's one of the biggest holiday hotspots, staycation areas in the whole of the UK. And this was a particular problem that came right to the forefront of the pandemic just before the lockdown came in, where Snowdonia National Park was, you know, experienced its busiest day when everyone was told to you know, stay at home. And so it really woke us up to this potential, as Avion mentioned before, about your population and how, you know, the council in Ceredigion managed to get rid of 35,000 people within a week. And so we went about to try and bring this message across to people and explain, well, actually, the safest thing, what should have happened, and this is a criticism of the UK government, they should have controlled the borders. They should have controlled them at the borders at the beginning. They didn't. It took months, and it's still a problem. Also, coming back to the point you said about evidence changing, I think it's knowledge that changes. And I think your perception and your going on what you already know, and you can look at the approach, look at Japan, for instance. Japan as a country assumed this virus was airborne. And so they implemented systems and processes to mitigate that right from the beginning. We didn't. We went with the WHO, of course, the authority, worldwide authority, but even they got it wrong. They tweeted, fact, COVID is not airborne. Fact, WHO was wrong. The evidence is clear, it's airborne. And, you know, since the end of the summer, myself and a colleague, Dr. Hugh Waters, we looked at the research, did a literature review, we shared it, published it. I brought it to the attention of the leaders in Cardiff, the council leaders, every single council leader in Wales was sent a reference to the website, freshair.wales, please have a look. And in that, the evidence was clear that this virus transmits in the air, and there are other mitigating processes that we can introduce to lower the risk. Now, that was at the end of the summer, and it's only in the last same month that the UK government, the Department of Health and so on, have been pushing the messaging of how you mitigate airborne transmission. I'm yet to see it from Welsh government being sent to the public. And this really riles me up, actually, because it is there and we should really be getting the messaging. And then you have to sort of reflect then, well, what's the messaging been in Wales? And I think you made an important point, which is we are assuming people know where to look for the information. And I, as a clinician, somebody who works in this field day in, day out, struggle sometimes. I've been looking at other countries, looking at Germany in particular, looking at what the evidence, what's the information they provide their citizens there, and finding the names of their departments and so on and agencies is very difficult. So to ask for Joe Bloggs to do it in Wales is very difficult. Somebody was, you know, for us coming back to tourism, I remember in the summer where issue was that, of course, England introduced mandating masks in public spaces and they didn't come in Wales for weeks. And we had tourists coming down, you know, coming from England or elsewhere in the UK, wearing the masks, donning their masks in the supermarket. And Welsh people were going around in the supermarket not wearing a mask. And I remember somebody turning to me and saying, I hadn't realised you didn't have COVID in Wales. You know, that wasn't right. And I had an argument with a politician saying, you know, oh, here's a letter I've done to tell all the tourists, please listen and respect the Welsh COVID rules. Well, I said to him, how on earth are they meant to know about it? Some of them don't even know that the Welsh Senedd exists. why could we not use technology such as automated text messaging? As soon as you hit the border, you send a message to everyone that comes across it. Here's a link, have a look, because the rules here are a bit different. There's a lot more that we could have done using technology.
I think your point about the point about how devolution and the difference in rules has cut through for the public in a totally different way, but that took a little while. I mean, that cut through in a totally different way than the last 20 years of devolution. And that's been, you know, that's been exacerbated by the difference in terms of announcements and press conferences from Downing Street and the clarification of which countries were being talked about at particular points in time, and the Welsh government's communications and the rhythm of those as well. I want to just pick up on, you know, one of the things around Japan and far other Far Eastern Asian countries have already a custom of using face masks in public already, and anybody who's seen lots of Japanese school children or visitors to London, for instance, in peak tourism season would have seen them wearing face masks as a matter of course. So this issue of custom and practice is also really important. And that's a really important issue, I'd imagine, also for you patients in terms of, you know, your communities and the people in your various communities that Race Council Cymru represents, also having different customs and practices. So there's a whole load of different things here that we need to unpick a bit. Richard, I'm coming to you now to talk a little bit about what can Wales and rest of the UK learn from Ceredigion in the first instance? And also, what are the other sorts of factors that, you know, we can't change, unfortunately, you know, more than 2,000 people have died in Wales. We can't change what's happened in the past, but we can still change and influence what happens in the future. What are the sorts of things that Welsh Government and people in positions of authority at the moment can change and influence to make sure that we have, we don't all suddenly, you know, it doesn't all go even worse to pot as the vaccine comes at us, because we're in what, we're on day three of the first vaccine so far, aren't we? Just to situate us in time, because it can get, you can forget where you are. And I hope people are keeping really careful logs of decisions and actions over these last few months. But what can we learn from Ceredigion, and what else can we change and should we change going forward?
I think, you know, Wales as a whole has done better at test, track and trace than England, for example. If you look at the number of contacts being traced in England, it's less than half in some times recently. In Wales, it's been above 90%. But it's still the case that the number of contacts being traced is much, much lower than we see in many parts of the world. So I think beefing up the test, track and trace, tracking more people is really, really important. I think it's really important to get the message across. There's been quite a feel in some parts of the media, particularly, that lockdown is a bad thing from an economic point of view. You know, there's a trade-off between the lockdown and the economy. And if we lock down, we're not going to work, we're not making money. But actually, if you look at the data, it's very, very clear that the countries that lock down hard and early actually do much better economically, because after you come out of your harsh lockdown, the levels are much lower, and therefore you can stay open for longer, and people feel safer going out and spending money and spending time, and they can do that more safely. So I think that message is really important to get across. And of course, the other really key point about lockdown is that lockdown only works if people comply, and people can only comply if A, they want to, and B, financially they are able to. And so it's really, really important that the messaging is there to encourage people to comply, and the financial support and the help is there to enable them to comply as well.
Yeah, and that's a key point for people who are forced to self-isolate with their children, for instance, who aren't able, and the additional payments to people on low incomes, enabling them to do that. But that's taking some time to come through. There's a couple of points in there, I think. One of the things around, you know, I wouldn't say we're getting better or more comfortable at living with uncertainty, but we're more conscious that we're living with uncertainty. And Avian, from your perspective as the chief exec of Ceredigion, you know, there's a whole heap of uncertainty around us, both in terms of COVID and what happens next, people returning to Ceredigion for Christmas as well, and the messaging around Christmas. And I think there's a conversation to be had, the five of us around that. But also, what happens with Brexit? You know, we're speaking sort of 3 days before the deadline, you know, the latest deadline, and we think the last deadline for a Brexit deal to be made. So, and we also are looking at elections, you know, six months down the line for the Senate, and that feels a long way off, but it isn't. So there's a whole heap of uncertainty in who is, you know, how are people who are earning a living from businesses that are going to be severely impacted by the 31st of December Brexit cutoff, and also, you know, what comes next? The furlough is there till the end of March at the moment from the UK government. No information about what happens after that.
Yeah, it's when you present it in that way, it's probably a doom and gloom picture for everybody. But the critical thing, Richard, is absolutely right. You know, what people need to focus on is how do we get ourselves safely through this problem, and track and trace. You can't underestimate the importance of getting the testing, the track and trace correct, because we were running our own track and trace system back in the end of March, and we'd had it in place throughout the first wave, and it really did serve us well at that point in time. But moving forward, I think that there's a need to develop the focus of the track and trace far more than what it currently focuses on, uh-huh. because all of our approach at the moment is defensive. We haven't yet got it in our mindsets to become offensive towards this virus. We're not going after it. Whenever we see the problem, we're shutting the bolting down the locking down the hatches, and you know everything that you said is a very scary picture, but if you take track and trace and you take it a little bit a further step forward, everybody's familiar with the R value, but in epidemiological terms, there's such a thing as K value, and that K value, I think we need to look upon that as the offensive way of attacking this virus, because if you trace, and Richard did touch on this in when he was mentioning track and trace, but if you go back, rather than look at, right, this individual is the index case, and then you identify the contacts of that index case. What we need to do in track and trace is actually trace backwards and find out where the source of that initial contact happened, and then try and identify the dispersal rate, which is what the K value is. So identify the dispersal rate, the potential dispersal rate, and then aggressively lock it down. And we've taken this approach in Cardigan, and I'll give you a very real example of how this can work and how quickly it can work. Three and a half, four weeks ago, we started to see a trickle of cases coming through, positive cases coming through in a single town. By the end of that weekend, it was a strong stream of cases. Right, we had to do the track and trace looking forward, but we also traced it backwards, and we identified it to four individual events and to two or three individuals, and I'm not going to disclose more information than that, but two or three individuals who'd visited relatives outside of the county and come back in and carried the virus back in with them. By the end of that week, our rate per 100,000 in that town was up to 800 per 100,000. So we immediately locked the whole thing down. As Ayla suggested, we locked the whole thing down very aggressive. We closed all our schools, primary and secondary schools, closed for 2 weeks. We closed the libraries. We used our enforcement powers to go in and close businesses down that needed to be closed down for two reasons. Not the first reason, if for those who weren't compliant with COVID regulations, but the second powers that we used were those where there was the potential risk to public health because they were honeypots for people to congregate. So we used our powers, we shut everything down. Within the space of 2 weeks, the rate per 100,000 in that town had dropped to below 200 per 100,000. And we were immediately able then to reopen the local economy and reopen. So if you take an aggressive approach and we start to use the language of going after this virus, not just defending ourselves from it, but let's chase it, let's go after it. And if we can go after it in an aggressive way, there are ways of containment of this virus and to suppress this virus without the need for a whole-scale good approach.
Thank you. Thank you, Vivian. Thank you. I think your point about language is really well made on, you know, on the back of that really clear example of what worked. And I'm going to go to some of the questions that have come through the chat room and to the panelists, because, you know, we've deliberately put a provocative title in ours and in today's conversation about Wales doing better. But there's a really interesting challenge and a really valid challenge, I think, from Judy in the chat, saying, hasn't this been achieved, doing better, has this been achieved at the expense of other illnesses, cancer care, orthopaedic care and so forth? Alia, can I come to you as a GP in terms of the other conditions and illnesses that aren't getting the care, or the backlog that is stacking up and going to hit us later?
Absolutely. So I tend to term all these things into one group, which probably is unfair, called the other harms of the pandemic. So, you know, people make the comment that the NHS has turned to the National COVID Service. And there's an element of truth to that, because it's all encompassing. It affects all the way that the NHS functions, particularly the elective work that is done by the NHS. A lot of it is obviously orthopaedic. This is a grave concern for us. And let's use this as an example. If you think about the condition of where you need to replace a joint, be it a knee or a hip commonly, the key thing with that condition is that you maintain your muscle mass, your ability to move. And because you increasingly develop pain with the condition, that prevents you from movement. So what we as GPs can do as we babysit these patients, because that's effectively what we're doing, is throwing painkillers, strong painkillers at them. These are opiate-based painkillers, and a degree of tolerance builds with these medications. And so we are adding an extra problem to the mix, which is opiate dependency. Now, opiates and painkillers generally can only do so much. And if you have to wait 2-3 years for a replacement of a joint, inevitably that will render you increasingly disabled. And your ability, once you finally get the operation to rehabilitate, is a much harder path to tread because of that loss of function, loss of muscle mass and so on. So this is a particular concern of ours.
So it's a compounding, isn't it? It's a compounding of those problems. And I know that the Health Foundation, which is a UK-based charity, is doing an inquiry into the impact of COVID onto health inequalities across the UK. And there'll be a Wales roundtable. There is a call for evidence that I'll ask one of the IWA team to share in the chat room, please. I am on the advisory group for that, and we'd really welcome really solid evidence from Wales in terms of that differential impact and what could happen. But it sounds as though you'd have a lot to contribute there, Alia. I'm conscious of time, so I'm going to come to you next, please. There's a good question here from Daniel Wincott in the chat room today, who's heard of some local authorities in England using recorded verbal messages on, for instance, WhatsApp, in a variety of languages used by communities in their own places and localities. Are you aware of this approach being used anywhere in Wales, or is everything written or visual on screens and on computers?
I'm hearing of this, to be honest, for the first time.
Okay.
It sounds like a very useful and way of doing this, a very useful approach. However, what we've done in Race Council Cymru is, because we support around 250 ethnic minority grassroots community groups, we've put them into 5 hubs across Wales.
Uh-huh.
So we've got a hub in Newport, covering the Newport area, Gwent area. We've got one in Cardiff and Vale, one in Swansea, one in Carmarthenshire, and one in North Wales. What we've done in the period of COVID, where we're not able to meet physically with these community groups, is we've created WhatsApp groups for each of the hubs, where we communicate and put out information there as well. But we haven't put all the members on the WhatsApp group. We've put the leaders of the group on the WhatsApp group, and we've asked them to then cascade. We expect them to relay the messages or the information back to their groups in the languages that they understand.
Okay, so there is a potential there for slightly different interpretations of the messages to continue onwards.
Yes, there is a potential, but what we've also done is we've asked them to pass their translations back onto us.
Okay.
So we kind of vet and make sure that the right information is contained within those translations before they go out to the community groups.
Okay, so there's a check and a balance in there.
Oh yeah, there's a check and a balance there as well, which is very, very important. Otherwise you end up distorting the information that should be going out to communities.
And certainly that method of cascading information through known and trusted individuals is something that's widely used in public health emergencies all around the world, or security situations. Yeah. Richard, I'm going to come back to you because...
We go back to all the time, sorry.
Sorry, patience, I didn't quite catch that.
No, I was just saying, we do know then that it's the same people we're going back to every time that we need to cascade information.
Yeah, okay. Richard, I'm going to come to you because one of the things this week with numbers rising again and the concern about numbers rising and Christmas being, you know, on the horizon and the desire, I think, to have as much as possible for understandable reasons a similar four nations approach, but you've got different tiers going on in England, you've got a whole Wales approach here. But Welsh government's indicated this week that people aren't following the rules. But, you know, do you think that perhaps the rules have become too complex for people to follow? Could you, hand on heart, say exactly what the rules are in every different place in the UK or even here where you are?
Absolutely not. No, I definitely wouldn't be able to tell you all the different rules in all the different tiers of England. And if you were to ask me to state all the rules in Wales, I'm sure I would get some of them wrong myself. You know, I've tended to adopt a cocoon myself away from other people as much as possible, apart from the family kind of approach, while keeping an eye on the really important rules. But I certainly couldn't tell you all the finer details at the moment, certainly.
So there's still an ongoing challenge, isn't there, in terms of how that's communicated and what that means for people who want to travel between you know, students coming home for Christmas or students going home for Christmas and people wanting to scoop up elderly relatives and who are on their own and be able to give them a hug, and what needs to happen to enable that to happen in as careful a way as safe a way as possible, recognizing that nothing is COVID secure at the moment, and there's a great challenge around that language. I think there's a comment here around, you know, looking at the performance of Wales in comparison to other countries in terms of numbers of cases, hospital admissions and fatalities is surely oversimplifying the key questions. Media and politicians who've taken this sort of league table approach are doing a disservice to their audiences and communities. What do you think, Aelia, and then Avion, would be a better way of communicating these challenges?
You want me to go first?
Please.
Yeah, I think there's definitely truth in that. It's a disservice when you compare from nation to nation. But I think, you know, trying to give the counter argument to the politicians, sometimes you have to use the same platform, which is quite evident with what's happening currently. You know, the Wales' rates of deaths and cases is increasing, whereas the other nations are dropping over the last couple of weeks. But in terms of ways of demonstrating, I think if you go on sort of on a more local basis, which actually this has come to the fore now on the Public Health Wales website, where you get a map where you can actually look and deep dive into more of a local area approach of what the numbers are like. And actually, we've got independent statisticians doing a great work off their own backs, trying to demonstrate what's going on. Laurie Williams from Cardiff University and Lloyd Warburton, the 17-year-old from Aberystwyth, doing a great service to the people of Wales in demonstrating what's going on. And I think it is important that we do realise that there are differences within Wales, rural versus urban and so on. And I think if you make it easy for people to access, that it's as fairly simple, that you keep it to the KISS principle, keep it simple, stupid, it's very difficult to go wrong.
Okay, thank you. Avion, can I come to you on that question too, please? And then we're going to look at the media stuff after that.
Yeah, I fully agree with Eilir. You know, the more local you can make the relevance of the information, the more likely it is that people will see the importance of looking after their own communities. If you keep on giving high level headline figures all the time, people in less affected areas become, and going back to my very first point about this complacency, you actually think, oh, it's not as bad, because you know when you boil that down into our local area, it can't be that bad. You have to give people the information about what the current situation looks like on the ground in their immediate localities, and talk to them about the strategies you intend to implement. And you know, it's very, very simple. The messages are simple. We, you know, the critical thing here is keep your distance from people. You need to keep your distance. And in order to keep your distance, whatever arrangements you've got in place for service delivery, for anything else, you have to try and reduce the possibility of transmission between various settings. So, you know, when you talk about bubbles in schools, they need to be an isolated unit. You can't have staff traveling between schools. Care homes, don't have people traveling between care homes. Keep them in isolated contained bubbles. In order to achieve that, you've got to overstaff it. But it's a much smaller price to pay than mass lockdown for, you know, continuous mass lockdown. So keep the messages simple and keep them local. You know, it's as simple as that.
Thanks, Eilir. Can you tell me a little bit about the kinds of PR either you or your leader in Ceredigion are undertaking on sort of on local radio, local TV things, local press, because that's part of it as well. And for lots of people, that'll be a new thing for them to be doing. I'm sure it isn't for you.
Well, one of the things we've done very recently, which has worked particularly well, is we've sent individual messages out to single towns. We told single towns, the virus in your town is increasing. You have to be so careful about how you share information at that granular level, because you need to have a balance between getting people to take notice of a problem, but you don't want to create that panic in that individual town or a blame culture either.
How have you shared it?
Facebook sites, Twitter accounts, community. There's sharing through the voluntary sector, local radio station, giving constant messages out. The local press, we invested heavily in the local press with weekly notifications going out there. But they're not the same generic old messages that people get bored with. They are relevant to the way wherever we see the pressure points. Mm. So we make sure that, you know, we are a fairly large geographical authority. Mm. Our line is probably about 55 miles long. So, you know, we need to be very specific when we tell people this particular area of this authority is seeing an increase at this moment in time. And immediately you see people's behavior change and the virus suddenly becomes contained again. It's when you give the headline figures at the national level constantly, people tend to become complacent with it.
So the contrast then in terms of, there's a question here from Hannah Watkin on the chat, which is, you know, the contrast between that local approach and what's hitting the headlines at a national level, and how quickly and how that can be sort of extrapolated into a different issue. The point that Hannah makes is Wales's fire breaks seem to make the national news more for the problems surrounding the furore about essential items being available in supermarkets rather than the actual rules and its later effects. And then because of how politicised comparisons between countries are seemingly inevitable, especially, Hannah says, between England and Wales, should we be campaigning for much more caution and equality from the media in how different policies between the nations of the UK are reported, so that we try and avoid any disproportionately unfavourable impressions being made about different governments' COVID policies? So there's a lot in that, isn't there? But about, I can see Patience and Eilir and Richard nodding too. Patience, can I come to you with that, please, in terms of how do we keep our eye on the ball of what matters for the communities that you're supporting? Because we're a long way from being out of the woods, aren't we? We're going into Christmas with a lot of people potentially already much more susceptible to respiratory infections, and other conditions as well as we go through winter. What are the sorts of things that you are doing to think about to support the communities that you're supporting?
The most important thing to us and the work that we're doing within our communities is the promotion of racial equality. And this, we have found, has been right at the center of the disproportionate effects, not only of the pandemic, but also of the sort of challenges that ethnic minority people have faced in Wales and the rest of the country over so many years. I don't think it was a coincidence that right in the middle of the pandemic, George Floyd was killed in the United States. And it sparked up the global Black Lives Matter campaigns, which have also been very active in Wales as well. I think it was very timely. It was like a call for us to wake up and look especially into the systemic and structural racism that exists within institutions, the sort of inequalities that have placed ethnic minority people in the positions that they are in today, making them more susceptible to COVID-19. So it's very important to us. And just yesterday, if I might share this, just yesterday, Race Council Cymru rolled out its Zero Tolerance Wales campaign to racism. And we've got a pledge of policy out there, and we're asking organizations and individuals to sign up to this to help alleviate the challenges of ethnic minority people. Sign up to the pledge, help us to hold you accountable. We can help you look at your diversity and inclusion policies and ways that you can improve on that to give ethnic minority people that equality, that chance that they need to improve their lives.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Patience. We'll put the link in the chat for everybody and make sure it goes out with the notes from this conversation as well to people. I think your point about people from Black, Asian, minority ethnic groups being disproportionately affected by the virus is a super important one, but also because of the socioeconomic positions in which many of them found themselves, but also both in terms of lower paid, more insecure jobs and what that meant, but also in terms of, for instance, frontline care workers and hospital workers and porters and cleaners and doctors and nurses and so forth as well. We're just about to run out of time. I think there's lots more that we could go for. I know there's a question here from Thomas Brooks that we haven't got to, which is about cross-contamination still happening in hospital COVID infection onset. I'm sorry, Thomas, that we haven't got to that one at the moment. I can see Aileen nodding that it's important. We are going to wrap up because we did promise everybody that we would finish on time today at 12 o'clock. I'd really like to thank you very much, all of you, for joining the conversation today. It's been a really interesting discussion and good from our perspective also to see things from a number of different viewpoints. There are no easy answers in any of this, and there is still a long road ahead for us all, both as individuals and in terms of the organisations that we belong to and the ones that we run. I think Patience's challenge to deal with and address racism in Wales is one of the key learning points that comes out of the whole of this experience for us all, but also our individual responsibilities as parents, as employees, as employers as well, and as citizens as well of Wales. I'd really like to thank our panellists for joining us today. Patience Bentu from Race Council Cymru, Avian Evans, Chief Exec of Ceredigion County Council, Dr. Richard Stanton, Reader in Virology at Cardiff University, and Dr. Ayla Hughes, who's a GP. Thank you very much indeed. This, as I said at the beginning, is the 12th in our series of Rethinking Wales sessions. Thank you to everybody who's joined us. Our next one will be on the 4th of February. We'll be taking a break from Rethinking Wales in January. At the IWA, we'll be launching our next media audit, which is the third in our series of research into how people consume media and the news in Wales and what that means for how they are able to play their role as active citizens. So the week of the 11th of January, there'll be a series of events on that and then another series of events the following week. If you want to receive early notifications of future IWA events, which will all be online for the time being, and recordings of all of our Rethinking Wales sessions, please do join us as a member through our website, and I'll put a link in the chat. And then you can help play your part in supporting an open, politically independent organisation at a crucial juncture for Wales. I also want to draw your attention to a partnership that we've convened with 10 other organisations across Wales, which is called the Live Learning Partnership, which launched publicly this week. One of the things that we're noticing is that many of these very important, detailed conversations are still happening from a very specific sectorally focused perspective. So these conversations are staying within those sectors and within the tracks that are already established. One of the things that we want to do is create a space where cross-sector learning can happen. So we've come together with the 9 other organisations, and I'll see if I can name them all now. Business in the Community, Cardiff Business School, Care Forum Wales, Community Housing Cymru, WCVA, ERLAB, I'm going to get stuck now on the last two, Cymorth Cymru, and get stuck on the last one. So somebody will remind me of the last one in a minute in the chat. And we have asked a key question, which is, what have you experienced and what have you learned since the beginning of all of this back in March? What lessons can you draw from this? Who do you think needs to hear about your experience? What kind of impact could this have? Could this have something be locally specific? And could it be significant and widespread? And to our knowledge, there's nothing else in Wales that is deliberately creating that space for that cross-sector learning. It's going to stay open for about another 7 months or so in the first instance. It's partially supported by the national, our role in it is partially supported by the National Lottery Community Fund in Wales. So we're very grateful to them. But the key thing for this is that all the data will be open source. It will be open to the public afterwards. So you will be able to share your stories publicly and read other people's and use all that data as well. So we're hoping that, again, that will provide a snapshot at different points in time. And already we can see the stories that are coming through from when we first launched it internally in July to the end of October, just before that first fire break, are very different in tone and content to what's come since then. So we'd really encourage you to share your own stories. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. And we hope to see you again in the new year. We hope you and your families have a quiet, safe and relaxing Christmas, and that we all have a far, far better 2021. Thank you. Diolch yn fawr.